everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Dean Mitchell. Please grab a seat in front of your favorite listening device or viewing tablet, or if you're listening in the car, buckle up. You're about to enter the smartest doctor in the room. Before we delve into this podcast, I thought this was so appropriate with my special guests. I want to acknowledge the tremendous gift given by Dr. Ruth Gottesman. Dr. Gottesman's family gifted $1 billion to Albert Einstein College of Medicine so that its current and future students could attend tuition-free. Now, Ken Langone should also get credit. He's done the same thing at NYU. And I don't think the public truly understands the tremendous ramifications this will have for future physicians who won't have to be saddled with enormous debt. And I believe, once again, medicine will attract the best and the brightest, not everybody running off to be a hedge fund or tech startup guy. So, and I think you're going to see in today's podcast, we're going to touch upon that, because the journey to becoming a doctor, especially a surgeon, is not the easiest road, physically, emotionally, or even financially. So today's topic is, what is life like for a cardiothoracic surgeon? So think about that for a second. A cardiothoracic surgeon is not the kind of job you just drive to work, you sit in your office, you shuffle some papers, you tap at a keyboard. You're holding someone's heart in your hands and their life. And just as an added note, you know, sludging through medical training is not exactly as it's portrayed on TV. It's more like a war. You're dealing with a physical and emotional pain, yours and your patients, every day. My guests today are Dr. Craig Smith and his wife, Trish Smith. I came across Dr. Smith's book when I was actually on vacation in Florida. You know, I get very antsy, so I was like kind of walking around the streets. I think it was in Palm Beach. And I wandered into this small little bookstore, and I saw his book, Nobility in Small Things. And I said, that looks like an interesting read. And I recognized his name, as he's a well-known surgeon, as we'll get into. And I did training at Columbia, so he's on my radar. And I couldn't put it down. It was so well written and at a tone that just resonated with me. Dr. Smith isn't any ordinary cardiothoracic surgeon. He's actually the chairman and the department of surgery at Columbia University Irving Medical Center in New York, at the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And he's actually also, we'll get into, the surgeon who operated on former President Clinton. I also invited Dr. Smith's wife, Trish, to be a co-guest because she, in her own right, is very accomplished as an attorney and an amateur athlete. And I think sometimes the general public doesn't realize what goes into being a doctor's spouse, especially a cardiothoracic surgeon, the sacrifices, you know, the spouse has to make for their marriage, for their whole family. So with that long introduction, but hopefully appropriate, I want to welcome, and I'm honored to have Dr. Craig Smith and Trish Smith to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, I think, Trish, you deserve a doctorate also. We'll put that in front of you.
Yeah, I was upgraded there.
Okay, so Dr. Smith, I guess we'll start off with, you have quite a busy schedule. You have early morning rounds, long surgeries. You're obviously in charge of the whole department there. Why take time to write this book depicting your personal and professional life so intimately?
Well, it's fair to say that it was not a goal I had set for myself at age 74, sometime in the past, that finally I got around to or anything like that. It was propelled by the attention given to the writing I did during the COVID pandemic that you're probably aware of. That
I learned about in the book. I actually didn't know about it. I can't wait to go back and read some of those. Yeah.
The simple summary is I just felt I had to be doing something like that to help lead the department. Ended up writing daily, what I called updates, 59 in a row. They got attention outside my space and led to agents and publishers asking if I would do a book, basically. So believe me, I recognize what a privilege that is. The average author does not get that.
It's tough. I know. Yeah. I published a book. It took me 5 years to get published. And I'm proud of it, but it's kind of like your work of art. You know, I'm sure I could tell, you know, one of the things I always tell patients, you know, because they ask me about my book and, you know, I talk about, you know, a lot of people, doctors sometimes publish a lot of books, but you could tell they didn't write it. You know, it's like they have all these ghost writers and everything. Clearly with yours, it just comes through every page. you know, how much of your, you know, your thinking went in there. If I was your publisher, though, I would have changed the title of the book to either The Accidental Surgeon or The Blue Collar Surgeon. Because when I was reading your book, I was struck how unusual it is that you became a doctor, let alone a top surgeon. I mean, you seem to have this artsy bent. You like music and writing. Then you went into ecology graduate school. Then you were a telephone lineman climbing up poles to fix faulty wires. This is not exactly, you know, the path that most pre-medical students take. Do you think that your path ended up serving you well?
Oh, I'd say so.
Yeah.
I think I acquired a lot of much needed maturity from going through all that. And I touch on this a little bit. I think I also matured through all the injuries I had in my youth, but
we're going to get to that. That's one of my other questions, how you chose your profession, considering your,
Yeah, but it was a maturing experience. It did make me respect the value of work, respect the people who do work.
Right. You know, I mean, like, you know, as you and I both know, I mean, I see all kinds of patients. I see some fancy, you know, VIP patients, but most of my patients are everyday, hardworking people. And I think even medical training really teaches you to hopefully relate better to patients and people, you know, because we're all out there just doing the best we can. Trish, I want to ask you, if I can, and I thought this was just really special about the book, and I think it's important, you know, for anyone in the partnership, how did you feel? I mean, you were, as Dr. Smith mentioned, you were accepted to a top law school, UVA. You put your own career on hold. I mean, maybe that was a little bit of the times, you know, but how did you come to terms with this? I mean, again, like your husband, as I mentioned, I'm teasing, you know, he was, you know, kind of wandering around deciding what's he going to be when he grows up. And you had to make a decision. I think you guys even had a family at that point. You had a little bit later. So how did you handle that? I mean, how does that work?
You know, things that seem like big decisions sometimes aren't. And okay. Craig's very, I was a little surprised he went to medical school, but we had already been married for a while then. And he was really passionate about it.
He was, okay.
And, you know, law school is always there. It isn't quite the experience that medical school is. And I like a good adventure.
Okay. Well, I know you kept yourself busy. I know he mentions in the book, you were busy TAing and I think it was up at Dartmouth and doing all your exercising. So I guess you kept yourself pretty busy. It wasn't like,
That's right.
Okay. Going back to Dr. Smith, you know, reading your book, you know, and always wondering why somebody becomes a cardiothoracic surgeon. I've actually had two cardiothoracic surgeons on my podcast. One was, I don't know if you know, Dr. Todd Rosengart at Baylor. He grew up down the block from me. You know, I always teased Todd. I said to him, you know, this show is the smartest doctor in the room. I said, he was the smartest kid in the school. I mean, we all knew he was becoming a doctor. Unfortunately, his dad passed away at a very young age from a heart attack, and it really motivated, you know, Todd to go into, you know, cardiovascular research and surgery. And then it's really funny, it hasn't been released yet, but I had Dr. LaMole on a week or two ago. So he's related to Dr. Oz. Yeah. But anyway, you know, becoming a surgeon, cardiothoracic surgeon, is a bit like climbing Mount Everest. It's quite a hike and you don't even know if you're ever going to make it. So what I want to ask you actually is, again, you grew up, even with all your injuries, you were an athlete. I think you said you played football at Williams. You know, how did you not end up in orthopedics? How did you end up being a cardiovascular surgeon?
Well, funny you should say that. I went into medical school assuming I would go into orthopedics.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because I'd had so much exposure to it. It just seemed like such a natural thing to do. And then when I finally saw it, when I was an intern and got to see what orthopedic surgery was all about, with all due respect to my orthopedic surgery friends, it just was a lot of hammering and sawing.
It really is like the carpentry. Is that, you know, once you get into medicine, everybody starts having all their analogies, you know, and it's kind of funny, like, too, like, you know, a lot of my, when I was in my first year or two of medical school, a lot of, you know, before you really go into the clinics, a lot of my friends, everybody's going to be a surgeon. I don't know. I wasn't really, that wasn't my bent. I'm like more of a thinker. And I love, like, you know, medical mysteries and clues. You know, I love the epidemiology guys. And it was funny. I'll never forget, once I was in the OR, I was like, you know, especially, you know, when you're a student, you're standing around a lot doing nothing. I was like, this is not for me, you know, scrubbing in. So you have to really know your personality and what you think you're going to be good at, obviously. Yeah. So what was the turning point with, again, with the cardiothoracic? You just, you did a rotation and you're like, wow, yeah, this is it.
That was very easy. My internship in Rochester had two very, very challenging rotations in the ICU, where we were, me and a fellow intern took care of the whole 19 beds, which was a large number of cardiac patients.
That is a lot.
So even before getting in the operating room, we'd been exposed to that fascinating and minute to minute challenging physiology that you deal with taking care of these people.
Right.
And then the minute I got in the operating room and just saw it open, that was it. I never looked back.
It just really, it must be, I mean, you see it on TV sometimes because, again, it's all played up. You know, you see them holding the heart. But I think when you're actually in the OR doing that, it must have like an incredible, probably never gets old, I assume.
No, it really doesn't. It really doesn't. And it's so much more than holding the heart. It's the
orchestra,
you know, it's.
Yeah. And you need a whole team, you know, which we'll get into, you know, again, we get to the President Clinton thing, because it's interesting. All right. I want to switch to a topic, which I also think is very important. And I think you mentioned that, which is really incredible for somebody who's really, you know, let's put it this way, part of the establishment, you know, at the top of the rung, you know, is the culture of medicine and surgery. And I think it's changing for the better, but I know in our years of training, and as you mentioned, you know, a lot of our attending physicians who taught us, it was like, you know, suck it up, you know, this is the way it is, this is the way it's always going to be. And as you mentioned, you know, in your book, it's like a little bit like the Hunger Games in surgery, you know, with the pyramid. I call it the survival of the fittest. And what I always thought, you know, pre-med and actually even into medical training, this is actually a really bad thing because, as you know so well, leading a team, it's a team sport. I mean, you do better when you're surrounded by really good people. But when people are sort of in competition with each other, or the biggest thing that I saw, and I'm sure you did too, you know, I trained during the AIDS epidemic at one of the Columbia affiliate hospitals. And, you know, we were all very young, for the most part, doctors. I mean, I was 24 years old, 25 years old when I was put on the ward, and I was in charge of 20 AIDS patients. And I think the number one thing, we were all afraid of making a mistake. I mean, we weren't assuming we were going to cure anybody. We just didn't want to make a mistake. And sometimes, you know, people make mistakes, you know, and I found that, again, sometimes the culture a little bit at that time was to berate the residents, you know, and from the resident to the intern, from the attending to the resident to the intern. And this would lead to what I found sometimes, people hiding their mistakes, which is even worse. So you're aware, and you mentioned in the book, you know, after that whole Libby Zion case and the Bell Commission, there were some supposedly radical changes made to medicine. You're in charge of the surgery program at Columbia Presbyterian. Has there been some major changes? What's your feeling about the best way to train the future Dr. Craig Smith, who's going to operate on one of our families someday?
Yeah. Well, that's a very broad question.
It's a deep question. I know. I jumped around a little bit. Take it in parts if you want.
I'll work maybe backwards.
Okay.
I think there's a difference between, I happen to think, and this is not orthodox doctrine.
Okay.
I happen to think it's, surgeons need to be trained differently than non-surgeons.
Okay.
And that there are differences among specialties that not only pertain to the training, but pertain to the skills and the stresses and what it takes to do the thing. An example I often point out is that hours restrictions and shift changes and things like that make perfect sense in fields that are essentially what we call vigilance tasks.
Mm-hmm.
Classic example of a vigilance task, which was actually quite a bit studied after World War II, is watching a radar screen. No, nothing could be more boring, but you're watching one blip. And that's very much like anesthesiology, like being in the emergency room and hoping you can pick out that one optic neuroma out of all the other headaches, the thousand other headaches. Those are vigilance tasks, and they require a different kind of attention, a different kind of rest than surgery. Despite the stories you hear, I have never seen anyone fall asleep in the operating room. I mean, in the
and those operations are long. Yeah. I mean, I know yours and right. those neurosurgery ones. I mean, yeah. those are. I mean, it seems superhuman. I don't even know how they do it. Or that, or at Columbia, you know, there's that really famous surgeon, the transplant surgeon. I forgot his name, but he used to like it was like a 24-hour operation. I'm like, how does he do it?
Well, you know do it because you've got to do it.
Well, you know what the funny thing? You just made me think of something really funny. I know where you're going with this a little bit. That you know about. I mean, because look. For a long time, look, we know being in residency is exhausting. You know, you're working like 36 hours. I mean, you maybe more. But it's almost like if people thought in sports, if a game went into overtime, it's not like Patrick Mahomes says, oh, you know, this is too many yeah. hours now. I can't play and let's bring in the substitute. Yeah. So I do see your point in that, you know, where, and you know, I can see like somebody's involved in a case. It's almost like you don't want to say, okay, my shift is up. I got to go home now, even though I'm tired a little bit, not to surge ahead where maybe your knowledge of the case might be critical in continuing either the operation or the care. Is that what you really kind of
yeah at? And I would argue that the system, regardless of which kind of thing you do, the system is better self-regulating than people give it credit for. Mm-hmm. So in those fields where vigilance is what counts, they have evolved towards more rational work hours and a different kind of structure. And in surgery, when you're a resident, yes, we had to work long hours, just like you did at your age. I mean, yes, you had to work 36 hours sometimes, but there was an end to it. Nobody worked 50 hours or 60.
That's true. That's true.
Because there was another resident who came and took over.
Yes, you couldn't wait.
and the truth is, even in those 36, 40-hour sieges, they were very seldom were truly sleepless. So you got by. And then yeah. when you become the attending, based on what you've learned as a resident about what your limits are, well, then you become your own regulator. And people are more rational at self-regulation than people seem to think. Yeah. So if it's really, and it just doesn't, there's so few times. Yes, I've done operations all night and half the next day, but it becomes very rare.
Yeah.
That you can get, if you really need help, you'll get help.
Right. Right. Well, especially in great institutions like yeah. yours. I want to ask you, you made me think about something. And it was a question I had for you about what makes a great cardiac surgeon. You know, actually Atul Gawande, who's the well-known writer from the New Yorker and the Harvard surgeon. I loved his articles. And one of his New Yorker articles I once read so carefully was that, I think it was in his article. There was like a group of psychologists, and they were interviewing surgeons in a pyramid program over many years, and at a famous institution. And they were just curious to see who are the ones that succeeded, you know, versus the ones who ended up having to drop out. So they were interviewing them, and the one thing that they really took away, I thought was interesting, was that the ones that didn't make it, typically when they would ask them, oh, what happened in this surgery, you know, when something went wrong? And that person would typically say, oh, you know, the guy that I was working with didn't provide the right anesthesia or, whatever. The guy came in, he was a mess and it just became more of a mess, right? And the people that succeeded, who ended up making it to the end of the pyramid, were like the ones when they were asked, oh, what happened in that surgery that went bad? And they go, you know, I thought about that a lot, you know, and if I could go back, this is what I would do differently. So I found that, again, this is a tidbit fascinating. But what do you think makes a great surgeon like yourself or like Dr. Michael DeBakey? What do you think? Is it the surgical skill? Do you think also, again, what DeBakey was very famous for was his pre-operative assessment. You know, who should I operate on? So, you know, for people who are saying, I want to go to the best cardiothoracic mm-hmm. surgeon in New York, and there's a lot of good institutions in New York. So,
well, it's not just the hands, for sure.
No.
It's, in fact, that's on the list. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot longer list of people who have the necessary manual dexterity,
right?
Learn the maneuvers that you do with your hands. It's the head, right. It's the brain hand connection. That's the differentiator.
What about the temperament? I mean, again, you did sports. Yeah. I've done sports. I was a tennis player in college. And what I've always admired, I never like it, just in my personality, I don't like people that fly off the handle. They might be really good, you know, and maybe it's appropriate in certain things, but I like the person who presents calm, you know, do you find, I mean, again, when you're, I mean, you make judgments, you're deciding on who's going to get into your prestigious program. Do you guys look at that? Is that, you know, besides their grades and et cetera?
For sure. To the extent we can, we're hobbled a little by having to rely on interview and testimony from people at the student's level when you're talking about who you take into training. But soon after, you begin to see who can handle themselves emotionally and who can't. And there's a tremendous amount of focus on this now in medicine, which is not inappropriate, although I think it's maybe getting a little overdone. But there's no question, you don't have to scream and yell at people to get done what has to get done. In fact, it's counterproductive after a certain point.
You know, it's funny. I had a funny story. In my medical school class, there was one outstanding student. He was brilliant. He was artistic. I mean, the guy, he used to, like, you know, anything he did was just really outstanding. And he wanted to be a surgeon. I think he wanted to be a plastic surgeon. And so when we did our, like, fourth year rotations, and, you know, everybody's, like, applying, you know, getting ready to decide, like, what field do you want to go into, whatever. He was doing trauma surgery at Bellevue, which, for our listeners, is one of, at the time, like, one of the most active places. And remember, he's a medical student. He's not an intern or even a resident. And I think there was like a multiple gunshot wound came in the middle of the night. And he was with like a second year resident on call that night on a Saturday night, whatever. And it was bad. You know, guy was bleeding out. I don't remember if it was a police officer or something. And so the second year resident turns to him because he was assisting, whatever. He goes, go call the chief resident. He's got to come in. And my colleague, my medical student says, no, we got this. And the guy, we end up hearing the story, you know, because the guy went crazy on him, which he probably should have. And he never became a surgeon. They kind of blackballed him, and he became a really good doctor in other ways, but it was just like a lesson, you know, humility is really quite important. Let's get to, handling VIP patients. They're not so easy. I've had a few myself. And they always want a lot of special care. And sometimes, you know, we both know this too. I mean, it'd be very dangerous, what we call the doctor hallway consults. I mean, how often does a colleague sometimes pull you aside? I'm not feeling so good about this. Or they call me on the phone, Dean, you know, I have this. What do you think I should do? You know, it's not really going through the proper channels. You're getting half the story. And we know, unfortunately, with our own families, that's usually the way it works. Like, you know, everybody wants the shortcuts. So you describe in quite detail your interesting experience operating on President Clinton, obviously with his permission, you know, doing his coronary bypass surgery. My question to you is, and I find this myself, do you find that when you are dealing with, quote, a VIP patient, that at times you have to almost like block out that they're a VIP patient because it starts to skew your normal, you know, process of treating a patient?
Oh, absolutely. I think the best protection they can get from you is to be routine. And to be treated as routine and not as a VIP. It's very hard. I mean, there's no perfect way to do that. But one of the reasons, as I'm sure you've learned, one of the reasons they often get pretty marginal care is because they seek out yes men, and they seek out people whose careers and reputation are staked on taking care of VIPs.
Right.
And there are only so many VIPs.
So yeah, they end up with,
you know, the least busy guy on Park Avenue who does vaccinations or something.
Right.
Taking care of your, you know, liver failure.
Yeah.
But I must say, the Clintons, as I hope came across in the book, were very good patients.
No, I know. They did. He really did. I mean, I had to like laugh. I hope people get the book and they get to read a little bit. Obviously, people who followed it, you know, he had a little bit of a complication just due to what happens in life. I mean, everybody's human. And he was like a little bit angry with his doctors. Like, how could this happen? You know, like we talk with all our patients, things happen. You know, we try to adjust and do the best that we can. And I thought your honesty was really tremendous. You know, one of the things, just going back to doctors' care on, you know, among their own colleagues, you know, it's funny. I once went to a doctor. I had to have a minor procedure done. And I went there. And purposely, I didn't tell him I was a doctor, you know, because I was going through, I just got tired. You know, when you go to a doctor, everybody's like hedging and hawing and this and that. And I didn't tell him. And right at the end of the thing, I guess because he didn't look in the beginning, He goes, you're a doctor. He goes, why didn't you tell me? You know, and I was like, I just wanted to get regular care, you know, for once in my life. You know, it's okay. So, all right. Before we go to Trish, on one other thing. I want to ask you, this could be a little bit controversial, but, you know, as we were talking about the culture of medicine and the way residents get treated, now residents are unionizing. What do you think? Now, it would seem incredulous to you or I when we were training doctors. Doctors are independent people, and, you know, why would they ever think of unionizing? But again, most doctors today are salaried employees of hospital networks, as are the residents. And sometimes they're getting the short end of a deal in a lot of situations dealing with the insurance companies or maybe their hours. I know you're in a little bit of a tricky position, but what's your thought about doctors unionizing?
Well, it is, and we both face tripping into a generational abyss that we don't want to trip into. But it is very hard to countenance, and hard for me to wrap my head around that notion. But for the reason you pointed out, one of the elements that used to make it sort of absurd may be changing. It used to be hard to imagine having a union that applies to people who are passing through something. You know, they're going to be there for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, off on their own. And it doesn't make quite as much sense to organize them and have a union when they're really just passing through in their education. It's become more common, though.
But well, I guess just for conditions, though. Who stands up for them when they, you know, whatever it is, you know, I don't know.
No, that's true. And as they become, as more and more emphasis is put on their working conditions, as opposed to the goal of training at the end of it all.
Right.
Then you can see if that's their main focus, the journey rather than the destination, well, then they might need some extra heft modifying the pleasure of the journey.
Right. Right.
And for the point, the reason you pointed out, if in fact in 10, 20 years, all doctors are going to be wage slaves, you know, working for, well, that's not a very pretty picture in my mind. And then the whole spectrum begins to make, you can see where collective bargaining would start to make some sense.
Right. Because you know what I'm thinking too, you know, so many patients are disappointed. I mean, you know, again, I've been practicing in New York 30 years. And again, I trained at one of the Columbia affiliates. Now it's Mount Sinai at St. Luke's Roosevelt. And it blows my mind that honestly, I'm on 57th Street, but so many of my colleagues who for years were people I could refer to have left New York. And honestly too, now what I'm seeing, you know, that doctors that are in like faculty practices, whether it's with Mount Sinai, NYU, probably even Columbia, you know, they are salaried employees. You know, if any of those institutions decide they maybe want to get a less expensive doctor or whatever, you're out. And if you think about it, like a doctor typically, again, like myself, I'm fortunate coming to my own private practice, but, you know, 20, 30 years, I've built up a following of patients who depend, rely on me. And I think so many doctors, I mean, maybe they like it. They can leave, they come, they go. They don't feel like they're tied to their patient base. But you'd be surprised how many patients, like when I bemoan, say, oh, my doctor left town or he retired early. And I just wonder that, again, if there was more security, again, in this change, which, again, was hard for me to fathom as well. Trust me, I can't ever imagine when I was going into medicine that I would be a card-carrying union member and, you know, and just working for a hospital. It just wasn't my dream. But I think the new reality for a lot of doctors, it's almost also even impossible to just open up, quote, your shingle and start a practice. I mean, that's, you know, with all the groups and everything, it's just not possible.
Well, that's another difference that you pointed out that not everybody thinks about, which is that, because they wouldn't know this, but especially in your kind of practice, if you're in a primary care practice or a medical specialty practice, your security that you would otherwise get from a union is your practice.
I know.
It's absolutely solid gold. If you've been in practice for 15 years and you have 2,000 patients, that's nobody can take that away from you.
No, yeah. My dad's old saying, because he was in sales, he goes, the inventory walks out every night, the door.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's still special to me. I say to my patients, I told them, I said, you know, not to be, you know, brag or anything. But I said, my name is still on the door. It says Mitchell Medical Group. I feel tremendous responsibility to uphold, you know, that relationship with my patients. Trish, I want to go back to you because, again, you and your and Dr. Smith were brutally honest in your book. And, you know, you shared about the heartbreaking loss of your daughter, Lydia, which I'm so sorry for.
Well, thank you.
Why did you feel comfortable sharing your story? And was there anything that you want to let the listeners know in regard to that?
It's something you never get over by enormous happenstance. Craig happened to be home that night. And he got Lydia to the hospital, and I stayed back with the two girls. Life changed forever. I mean, and it's a long time back now, but still. What you do learn is that the next day or the week later, you pick yourself up, you put your shoes on, you go out the door to work, and you move on. Yeah. You have to move on. You have two kids. You have to move on.
I know. I guess, yeah. I mean, we've had some close friends who've lost children, and it's kind of unfathomable, but you're right. I guess it just... You know, I guess we also feel we have this purpose in this life, and that's what keeps us going. And I guess we hope our loved ones, if they passed, still hope we do our work. So, Dr. Smith, you mentioned something interesting in the book too. At the end, you know, one of your sort of interesting hobby was taking photos from your super view of the Hudson River, I think. Why did you do that again? What were you hoping to do?
Well, I had just. In the year or two prior to that, one of my daughters gave me a good camera and I started taking a lot of pictures and I got
okay. You had a new toy.
Hooked on it. So, and I had been looking out this view for years and had always been struck by how variable it is, you know, which is, it seems so trite because it is, but the seasons and everything else.
Yeah.
It is a great view. So I thought I just set as a project for myself to take a picture every day. And there's just, that sounds easy enough, but there's more to that than meets the eye to get a good picture.
Yeah, sure.
Night, daytime, morning, noon, night, you know, through glass, you have to figure out how to do that and all that. So I played around with that for a year, as I said I would. I missed a few days here and there. Mm-hmm. And I ended up with all these, you know, 1,400 some photos to
wow.
edit. And then I had to learn how to edit them.
that's the hardest part.
So that took a year or two.
Yeah. I have to say something also about just talking about Columbia Presbyterian on 168th Street. You know, when I was a resident at St. Luke's Roosevelt on 59th Street, later on, some of my training took me up there. I did some dermatology, allergy, immunology, infectious disease up there. And I can't explain it, but going up there, I felt this sense of history. You know, walking around the buildings. I was thinking about just before we went on, I said the analogy would have been, and I haven't been there in a long time, would have probably been going to old Yankee Stadium. You know, you walk into that stadium and you know that Babe Ruth had got up to plate there, you know, and Mickey Mantle later on. And I can't explain it, but whenever I would go up to Presbyterian, I got that feeling. And I was also always so excited when I would get to teach the medical students. They were so super smart. I was like, so I used to always say, I said, I think we're in good hands for the next generation. And they used to push me to be a better, you know, resident or attending, you know. So it is such a privilege, you know, to be part of that community. Dr. Smith, in kind of coming to a conclusion here, we didn't talk about anything really about the heart. I mean, there's so many things we can talk about, aortic valves and bypass, but what would be your most important tip for someone to avoid your OR? If you had a person, a younger person saying, you know what, I would really like to avoid having bypass surgery or something. Is there anything that in all of your walk, you know, experience?
Simple things. It's the simple and obvious things. Don't smoke. Don't be overweight. Stay fit. You do those three things, that will take you a long way. Things like specific details of a diet can matter, but you start overlapping there with metabolic heredity and things like that.
Yes,
and at the margins, heredity is a big part of it.
Yeah.
So you do what you can do. Of course, wear your seat. don't smoke, and so on.
Well, you know, you say something really important that I really focus on in my own practice, not to scare people, but I tell them, I think more than any other part of the medical history, your family history, if you can, know your family's issues. It's like, it's kind of funny. I over the years, I found I've ended up developing so many issues that my mom had, you know, and I go turn around to her and say, oh, I got this problem. She goes, oh, I've had that problem for a long time. You know, it's like I said, I really should be talking to you more often, Mom, you know, and I have one other interesting quick story I just want to share for the listeners, because my own tip, sometimes I got to throw something in. When I was I'll never forget, like, I think it was a second year resident working in the ER at St. Luke's Roosevelt. It was like, must have been like a Saturday night in the summer. It was very warm. I just remember, and we're near Central Park. And a patient comes in and they put him in like the surgical area room. And the surgical resident was really nice. He says, hey, you could take this one. You know, he knows I was just getting used to all the medical stuff, the cardiac arrest. He says, maybe I can use something a little, you know, lighter. So I go into the room and the patient's all gowned because he fell and he had a laceration on his scalp. So I was busy there, you know, sewing him up, whatever. And he's busy talking away. But actually, right before we we sewed him up, I sewed him up. We did a cardiogram on him because we thought maybe he had a syncope thing. Like, why did he fall? And his cardiogram, I think he was at that time, he seemed old to me, but now I'm 63. He was like in his 60s. His EKG was like, looked perfect. And I'm sewing him up with the light shining down. But I also glanced down because he was wearing shorts. His legs were so muscular, I couldn't believe it. You know, the rest of his body was smaller. So I'm busy sewing him up and we finish and we're talking. I said, I have to ask you. I said, your cardiogram is great. You look so much younger than your years. I said, what do you do? And he said, I'm a professional race walker. And then I said, wow. I said, kind of the light bulb went off. I said, you walk all over the place. You never get hurt. I said, that's the secret to longevity. Anyway, anything else either one of you want to add as we kind of come to a conclusion here?
No, I think I think Trish had a great observation on the typical question Trish has asked is, was it worth all the sacrifices she and the family made for me?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. That is the question.
What's your answer?
What's the answer?
My answer always is we didn't make any sacrifices. We lived our lives. We had a great time. What made it worth it to you to miss all that?
Wow.
So I'm the one who sacrificed, and she has a point.
Yeah. But wow, that's such a strong partnership to say that. And I think it is like in the conclusion, it's like, it is the journey. People, you know, I as hard as residency was, and I think I would ever want to do it again, I don't think I would ever trade it for the experience. I mean, even to this day, you know, when I've had family members that had some cardiac issues, and that's not my field now, I do immunology and everything too, but I'm able to actually like remember things that I was taught so well by cardiologists and the surgeons, and it served me well. And so it was an experience that you know, you live with forever, and hopefully you don't regret any of the things because it's part of the journey. So anyway, I totally recommend for anyone who wants to know, has any interest in the life of a surgeon or just a really good read, Nobility in Small Things, A Surgeon's Path. It's just a great read. And if you're thinking of becoming a cardiac surgeon, absolutely, you better not miss it. So thank you again, Dr. Craig Smith and Mrs. Trish Smith, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. That was really great.